Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, July 13th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, offering the greater Saratoga community telehealth and safe in-office visits at Saratoga Hospital Urgent Care, Primary Care, at its specialty providers, saratogahospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday are Dr. Regina Resta, a board-certified and fellowship-trained medical oncologist and hematologist at Nurse Practitioner Erin Lasher of New York Oncology Hematology's Troy office. If you have a question about cancer or hematology, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Resta, Nurse Lasher, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop Medical Monday, right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two guests on the line today to answer your questions about cancer treatments. Dr. Regina Resta is a board-certified and fellowship-trained medical oncologist and hematologist. She sees patients at New York Oncology Hematology's Troy office on Hoosick Street. Dr. Resta completed her bachelor's degree and attended medical school at Washington University in St. Louis. In addition to treating patients at New York Oncology Hematology, Dr. Resta also volunteers at a medical clinic for the homeless. Working closely with Dr. Resta is nurse practitioner Erin Lasher. Nurse Lasher received her associate's degree in nursing at Maria College, went on to complete a bachelor's in biology at Russell Sage, and completed her master's of science in nursing at Sage Graduate School. She is certified in both chemotherapy and biotherapy. If you want to be a part of today's conversation, call early, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Resta and Nurse Lasher, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Resta, one study reports that during this pandemic, this COVID-19 lockdown, which has affected so many people, cancer screenings are way down, 80-90%. What gives and why is that so dangerous?
Well, I am familiar with that study, and I think many, it's one of the things that as oncologists we really worry about, because we know that most cancers, the best way to treat them is to catch them early. And so people have delayed coming to the doctor ever since the COVID pandemic started in New York in March, and we're just starting now to pick up. Our patient visits were down for sure over the last 100 days. CAT scan screenings, follow-up, mammograms, colonoscopies, all of these have been delayed, with numbers estimated to be down by about 90% based upon a study done by an Epic, a large electronic medical record firm. So we're worried about what this means for the future.
I mean, are there specific cancers where early detection makes a bigger difference?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Almost every cancer, certainly mammograms and breast cancer, colonoscopy for colon cancer, skin cancer, early detection, melanoma. It's hard, actually, to think of a cancer that early detection doesn't make a big difference.
I guess my question was, are there ones that are more important to have that early detection?
More important. Erin, what do you think? What's more important?
Honestly, I think it's important to screen for all cancers. I mean, important step is to at least see your primary care doctor every year and stay in contact with them so they can tell if you're having any changes in your overall health, and then, you know, do further screening based on that.
Can you explain how treatment could differ for somebody who finds cancer, who, in other words, maybe waited 3 months and then comes in and the cancer is further along? How does that treatment change?
I'll take that one, Erin.
Okay.
The first thing we think of when we see a patient with cancer is, what are the goals of treatment? So are we trying to cure this patient, or are we trying to palliate or make the symptoms better, or, you know, make your quality of life better? And if you come in with a small mammographically detected breast cancer, that is almost always cured with surgery and sometimes radiation. We like to avoid having to give chemotherapy, but if you wait 3 months and the cancer is spread, then it's much more likely you're going to require chemotherapy, which, as an oncologist, although that's what I do, I'd rather not.
I'll throw this one to nurse practitioner Erin Lasher. What steps have you taken at NYOH to make sure that everybody's safe during these very strange times?
As far as precautions in place for COVID?
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically, any patient who comes through the door is given a mask if they don't already have one on. We're limiting visits to only patients, which can be difficult for them and family. But we do ask that the family stay outside. We do allow and often have the cell phone with us, and we do involve the family member in that way. We are also offering virtual health visits, so that can keep them home and keep them safe rather than bringing them into the office.
The number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by nurse practitioner Erin Lasher and Dr. Regina Resta of New York Oncology Hematology. And let's grab a call or two before the first break. Pat in Beacon, you're on.
Hi, I had a question regarding hematology. Has a doctor ever had experience where spherocytosis was present in a child and not in the parent?
I guess I'll take that one. spherocytosis is usually a hereditary disease. The name of it is hereditary spherocytosis. But it can occur as a spontaneous mutation in a patient. So therefore, the kid could have it, and neither of the parents have it. Of course, you always have to make sure those are your parents. But yes, you can have a spontaneous mutation.
What is the illness?
So spherocytosis is a hematologic disorder in which the cytoskeleton of the red blood cells will have a specific abnormality in the membrane. So a certain protein is not present, or if it's present, it's mutated. And that makes the red cell more prone to sort of getting beat up in the circulation and getting destroyed. And so if you look at those cells under the microscope, rather than having the nice central pallor, which is the paleness in the middle of a red cell, which is like a disc, you'll just have a sphere, a solid reddish-colored sphere. So those cells are less deformable, less bendable and flexible, and more prone, therefore, to get sort of eaten up in the circulation, and the patient will get anemic. It's often a very mild issue. And so people don't even sometimes need treatment for it. On the other hand, it can be more serious and require intervention, such as taking the spleen out.
Pat, do you want to follow up?
No, that's actually the exact treatment that was done in my daughter. They removed her spleen, but it took 20 years to figure out what was wrong.
Why, Dr. Resta, would it take so long to figure that out?
it's not all that well recognized a disorder, even though it's not that rare. Actually, you can see it in maybe 1 in 5,000 people. It's just not that well recognized a disorder, and the patients are not usually that sick either, so that they would have to first recognize to be anemic, so somebody should have done a blood count at some point. Mm-hmm. So in this particular case, I can't really tell why it took so long, but hopefully it's because it was a mild disorder.
Well, Pat, thank you very much for the call. We have to take a break here. We are joined today by Dr. Regina Resta and nurse practitioner Erin Lasher of New York Oncology Hematology. If you have a question about cancer, give us a call, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll be right back. Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We're joined today by nurse practitioner Erin Lasher and Dr. Regina Resta, both of New York Oncology Hematology. And let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
What connection, if any, is there between Epstein-Barr virus and hairy cell leukemia?
I'm sorry, I didn't really hear that question. Hairy cell leukemia and what?
Epstein-Barr.
Yeah. Oh, boy, you really, I should have studied for my hematology boards again.
Well, Jim and Matamoros likes to pose tough questions, so it's like a game show in many ways. Go ahead.
Okay, so this is Jeopardy.
Yes.
So hairy cell leukemia is a very uncommon leukemia, and it looks really cool under the microscope because the white blood cells have hairy-looking projections on them, and that's how it got its name. And years ago, when I first started out in hematology oncology, we really didn't have very good treatments for hairy cell leukemia. But probably over the last 15 years, we've had a number of excellent treatments that can almost always put people into remission for a very long time. And sometimes cure them. So hairy cell, it comes from a B cell, which is also the cell that would be involved with Epstein-Barr virus, but I'm honestly not aware of any specific correlation between Epstein-Barr virus infection and hairy cell leukemia.
All right, Jim, thanks very much for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by nurse Erin Lasher and Dr. Regina Resta today from New York Oncology Hematology. One of the things in my neighborhood, and I'm sure yours as well, that I've seen a lot of during the so-called lockdown is people taking walks. And this is a very good thing. However, you know, people are outside, they're gardening, they're walking. There is the concern about skin cancer. And I just wondered if perhaps we'll start with Nurse Lasher and then we'll go to Dr. Resta. Some tips for being safe in the sun.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be out in the sun getting exercise, that's definitely a great thing. But there are things you can do to protect yourself. Wearing sunscreen is one great thing you can do. SPF of 15 or higher is best. Wearing a hat, especially with a wide brim to kind of shade your face. Wearing sunglasses to protect your eyes. I know it's hot out, so we don't really want to wear long sleeves and pants, but they do make nice, like, lightweight long sleeve shirts that offer great protection. Some of them are even with SPF in them. Definitely would recommend doing that if you already have a history of skin cancer. The more protected you are, the better.
Dr. Resta, you know, there is this fine line, I assume. Vitamin D is a very good, wonderful thing, and we all need it. And I've heard, you know, people say, hey, well, you need a little sun. How do you draw that line and keep yourself safe while getting out there and getting that proper sun?
Yeah, so I think that really, really strict sun protection does increase the risk for vitamin D deficiency, especially when you live in these northern climes like we do in upstate New York. But you can always take oral vitamin D supplement if you have to. Your provider can check a vitamin D level, and if your levels are low, you can take a supplement. To add on also to what Erin said is that if you see a mole that looks suspicious or something that looks different, don't put off going to see somebody about it. A lot of people are doing virtual visits, and certainly a dermatologist can look at things on a virtual visit and let you know that this is something to worry about.
What makes a mole suspicious?
There are a number of things that you can look for. Number one would be if it changes. So you know your own body, so get a look at things. And if it changes, then that's one thing to be worried about. Irregular edges on a mole. So rather than, you know, a perfect oval or a perfect circle, it might have a spreading edge.
Yeah.
And certainly something like if something bleeds, that would be something you ought to be worried about. So those are the suspicious things to look for.
We are joined today by Dr. Regina Resta and Nurse Erin Lasher of New York Oncology Hematology. A couple of emails here. A number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, 1-800-348-2551. Mark writes, most of us have heard of oncology and the role of oncologists when it comes to getting treatment for cancer. But can you please explain what is the connection with hematology? Does hematology always mean cancer? And that is from Mark.
That's an excellent question, because hematology, no, does not always mean cancer. And I think the connection between the two of them is historical. I don't know if Mark read that book, The Emperor of All Maladies, Cancer, which is just an excellent book about the history of cancer. But most of the original effective chemotherapy regimens came out for malignant hematologic processes, such as leukemias. And then it expanded into lymphomas, such as Hodgkin's lymphomas and non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. And so the two specialties, hematology is sort of an ancient specialty. It's been there for a long time. But oncology is a younger specialty. And I think probably only in the early 70s came out as a distinct specialty. Certainly there are people who are just medical oncologists and just hematologists, but I think the two of them sort of grew up together. Mm. Oncology is sort of the stepchild of hematology. So that's the connection.
You know, you mentioned very early chemotherapy. When did chemotherapy actually begin, and what have we learned, and what has changed since the beginning?
The earliest chemotherapies were probably anti-metabolites. So that came out in the 1950s, methotrexate and its other drugs that interfere with DNA synthesis. So when they first came out, they really chemotherapy came out as a very non-specific sort of cell poison, if you will, so that when a cell is dividing rapidly, as cancer often does, it needs to make a lot of DNA. In order to make that DNA, you need to be able to replicate or divide and reproduce the DNA. And so non-specifically interfering with DNA replication or cell division was the way chemotherapy worked. And so it would hit all rapidly dividing cells. So, for example, with leukemia, the leukemia cells divide rapidly. So the anti-metabolites will interfere with that. More and more nowadays, we are thankfully going towards more targeted therapies, if you will. So not just non-specifically hitting rapidly dividing cells, but picking out something that is wrong or mutated in a particular cancer and creating a drug that targets that. That's our goal, and we're getting there.
Does that make for less bad effects and side effects and, you know, oftentimes a cancer patient would say, God, you know, the cure is worse than the illness.
Yeah. Erin, what do you think? We have less side effects when we treat somebody with, let's say, a monoclonal antibody for breast cancer as compared to using chemotherapy for breast cancer?
I don't know if we have less. I mean, I feel like we have different side effects, sometimes more tolerable side effects, but I don't know. People tend to do better on the immunotherapies as opposed to the traditional chemotherapies, but there are still side effects.
Our number here is 800. Go ahead, pick it up.
I didn't know if Dr. Resta wanted to elaborate on that or not.
No, I think your point that the side effects are different, that's very important. So people tend, for example, not to have the classical side effects that you think about, such as losing your hair, or nausea and vomiting, or lowering your blood counts. But there are other very specific side effects that we see, and we have to be careful for, and we're learning all the time.
We're joined today by Dr. Regina Resta and nurse practitioner Erin Lasher of New York Oncology Hematology. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and we will get right back to the phones. One more email, though. This one came in from Cass, and Cass writes, I was diagnosed with stage 1 melanoma on my right foot, removed via surgery, clean margins, and had sentinel node biopsy in groin, which was negative. I never followed up with oncologist beyond the surgery. Should I? I'm up to 6 month skin checks at dermatologist. My dermatologist said if I had it once, I will likely see a recurrence. Is that true, or do you think they meant chances of getting it elsewhere as another incident of occurrence versus this one coming back? And that is from Cass.
Well, first of all, it's hard to say without, you know, looking at your chart and all of that
right.
sort of stuff. But in general, when melanoma is caught early, as we were just talking about earlier in the show, when cancers are caught earlier, this is a stage one disease. There's no lymph node involvement. The chance of recurrence is very low. When I do get to see these patients, and I don't always get to see them as a medical oncologist, but when I do, I usually tell them that the most important thing you can do is to follow up with your dermatologist, and if you see anything suspicious, show your dermatologist, get it biopsied, because the chances of getting a second melanoma are much higher in anyone who has had a first melanoma, and I think the chances of getting a recurrence of a stage one melanoma with negative lymph nodes are very low. In other words, the chance of it spreading somewhere else in your body. Much more worried about getting a second melanoma.
But now Cass's question, though, one of them was, you know, should she have gone back to the oncologist beyond the surgery?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And usually I'll see these patients once, and as long as they have a good dermatologist and or a good internist, they don't really need to keep coming back to see the medical oncologist. So some patients like to do that, and sure, they can come back. But no, if you have a good dermatologist, good primary care doctor, they can take care of it.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. And back to the phones we go. Sue in Brunswick. Sue, you're on.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how often it is recommended to have a mammogram after the age of 76. I'm 76, and I am interested in whether I should have a mammogram or whether also for colonoscopies. I'm also asking about that. What's the recommended timetable for that?
Who would like to answer this one?
I can take that. This is Dr. Resta.
Okay, Dr. Resta.
I think your chronological age is just a number. So your physiologic age is a lot more important. But in general, most screening guidelines suggest that once you're over the age of 74, we look at what your life expectancy is. And so if you're in good shape for your age and we think you have a life expectancy of over 10 years, then you can continue doing mammograms maybe every other year. And there's not really an upper age limit where we say you should stop. So it's really a matter of your physiologic age. And to a certain extent, the same thing goes for colonoscopy. But of course, both of these things are going to depend upon your personal and family history, which you can discuss with your primary care provider, whether you're at particular risk. Now, a mammogram has a lot less potential side effect than a screening colonoscopy, so you have to take that into account as well. So the bottom line is, you're only as young as you feel.
Mm-hmm. What are the side effects, you say, for a colonoscopy?
Well, a colonoscopy is an invasive procedure, so that, you know, any time you're going to be doing an invasive procedure, there's risks of things like perforation or complications from the anesthesia. Even though these are very uncommon, I think as you get up in years, you have to think about these risks. Mammogram, relatively low-risk procedure. There are other screens for colon cancer that have come out really just in the last couple of years, which look at DNA in the stool and look for particular mutations that suggest that you might have a colon cancer. And that can be done as a screen. It's relatively low risk. And for patients then who screen positive with this sort of a DNA test, those people may need to go on to colonoscopy.
Sue, thank you very much for the call. We're joined today by Nurse Erin Lasher and Dr. Regina Resta of New York Oncology Hematology on this Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Russ in Waterford. Russ.
Yes. My son is 21 years old. and he had a DVT. And as a result, he was seeing a blood doctor, and he's been on Eliquis. He had it about 3 months ago. And before he was released from the doctor's care, they did a test and found out that he has factor V Leiden. And I was recently tested. I do not have it. My wife is currently being tested. But the doctor wants him to stay on Eliquis basically forever. And he's 21, and he's hesitant about being on drugs for his whole life. I didn't know if you knew about factor V Leiden or had any thought on it.
Sure. I'm old enough to say that. There was a time when I didn't know about factor V Leiden, and people would have blood clots, and we didn't know why. But now there's a number of hereditary, what we call thrombophilias, where people are predisposed to blood clot. The thing about something like factor V Leiden is that it's relatively common to have this particular mutation in factor V. So factor V is one of the coagulation factors that are necessary to form a blood clot. But the majority of people with factor V Leiden never have a blood clot. So we don't take everybody with factor V Leiden and put them on a blood thinner. I think something like 1 in 20 people in America have the factor V Leiden mutation. Most of these people don't have blood clots. So I would encourage your son to talk to the physician about, you know, why in his particular case he thinks he should stay on the blood thinner forever. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say they considered it a provoked incident. I don't know if that matters or not. Just develop a blood.
What does that mean, a provoked incident?
So that means when somebody has a blood clot, the first question we ask is, why did they have a blood clot? Hmm. Did they just take a 12-hour train ride in Siberia or a flight over from Europe, some reason where they were immobile, they have surgery, some kind of trauma? So that's a provoked incident. In general, we don't recommend indefinite blood thinner in somebody who has a provoked incident. So I don't know in your son's particular case, you know, what the situation is, but I'd encourage him to talk about that with his physician.
Well, you were talking about your age, so let me just tell you, I'm 65. My son is 21. My son, the reason we believe he got this blood clot was he was at a gaming convention, video gaming convention.
Oh,
and he was sitting with his legs crossed over a console for I don't know how many hours.
Wow.
And I think that that's what probably provoked this.
So, yes. You just taught me something, because I don't ask that question usually. I ask if they've been on an airplane or something, but now I'm going to ask about gaming conventions.
Well, Russ, we have to take a break, but thank you very much for an interesting call. Dr. Regina Resta is with us, as is nurse practitioner Aaron Lasher, both of New York Oncology Hematology. We'll take a quick break and hit the phones once again. 800-348-2551 is the number. Medical Monday, Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is our number. We're joined today by Dr. Regina Resta and nurse practitioner Aaron Lasher of New York Oncology Hematology. Before we get back to the phones, in your CV, Nurse Lasher, it says you're certified in both chemotherapy and biotherapy. What is biotherapy?
That's like the immunotherapies, the newer they're not chemotherapies, but the targeted therapies.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Gloria in Cambridge. Gloria.
Hi. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I guess this might... I'm good. This might actually be about biotherapy. I'm not sure, but to both doctors, is there a... in regards to esophageal adenocarcinoma, stage 4, stage 3, any stage, is there any research being done for esophageal cancer? And if so, where? And with screening for esophageal cancer? Are they working on maybe allowing the insurance companies to pay for endoscopies for people to have to start screening for esophageal cancer because it's a silent killer?
I think insurance companies do pay for that, don't they?
Not for screening.
All right, go ahead. Who wants this one?
I'll take that. Okay, Aaron, you can add in. But in general, esophageal cancer is relatively uncommon, but it does usually present with some sort of symptoms. And so if you have any symptoms, your insurance company will pay for screening, which is the upper endoscopy, where it's sort of like a colonoscopy, but they do it from the other end. So they usually do pay for screening,
yeah.
But you're not going to screen the entire population and do an endoscopy because it's not all that common to have esophageal cancer. So that's I'm sorry, the question was complicated. There were many other parts to it, so I don't know. Maybe you want to repeat
Gloria.
The second part.
Do you know if they are doing any more research on it and if they have come up with any trials or I think the other, I don't know who was talking about biotherapy instead of chemotherapy. Is there any research being done for adenocarcinoma?
So there's plenty of research. There's never enough research, but there is plenty of research. And certainly at NYOH, we have clinical trials for treatment of esophagus cancer. We don't have trials locally for screening for esophagus cancer. The major treatment for esophagus cancer is, like many cancers, to try to catch it early when you can operate on it. Frequently, chemotherapy and radiation will be part of the treatment for anything that's beyond the most early stages. So esophagus cancer is often treated by radiation and chemotherapy followed by surgery. As far as immunotherapy or targeted therapy, there are some targets that we know of in esophagus cancer. So, for example, certain gastroesophageal cancers express the HER2-new protein, in which case the monoclonal antibodies against the HER2-new protein can be used to improve the results of treatment of more advanced disease. And recently, treatment has been approved, immunotherapy treatments have been approved for more advanced cases of esophagus cancer if they have specific sort of genetic hallmarks that we can look for. So yes, there's active ongoing research in treating esophagus cancer.
Gloria, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday. We're joined today by Dr. Regina Resta, Nurse Aaron Lesher of New York Oncology Hematology. One email here, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one is from Andrea. Andrea writes, I was diagnosed with severe aplastic anemia in 1980 at the age of 24. Over 25 years, I had 5 courses of anti-thymocyte globulin, ATG, along with high-dose prednisone, no bone marrow transplant because I'm an only child. My last treatment was in 2002. My counts have been good since. I contracted hep C from an early transfusion but eliminated the virus with Harvoni. What are the chances that I might develop MDS? Myelodysplastic syndrome, I guess, at a later age. I am now 64, and that's from Andrea.
So when I have a patient with aplastic anemia, I make sure they see one of the physicians in NYOH who specialize in malignant hematology. And that's one of the joys of being in a large practice, frankly. I can get on the phone or send an email and get them to the places where they need to be. But she has a very good, Andrea has a very good chance of remaining in remission forever. There is an association of aplastic anemia with a disorder called either PNH or paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, and myelodysplastic syndrome. But MDS is seen really in a minority of patients with aplastic anemia, maybe 10%. So the majority do fine.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Julie in Vermont. Julie.
Hi, I had a quick question for the doctors. I just had a mastectomy and had a expander placed, and about a month and a half after that, I had a skin reaction on top of the expander site. And it ended up being an allergic reaction, and it did become systemic. And the only medication I was taking at the time was tamoxifen. And I was wondering if the doctors have ever heard of someone having an allergic reaction that manifested itself in that way after taking tamoxifen.
So was the reaction just over where the expander was, or did you have it all over your body?
Initially it was. And then about a week later, it started showing up on different parts of my body, like my chest, my arms, and my neck and face.
Yeah, I have to admit that I've never seen anyone have a systemic reaction. I've seen deflations and that kind of thing, but I've never seen anyone have a systemic reaction. Did you ask your plastic surgeon?
Yes, I'm investigating the tamoxifen part, and I heard the same thing. No one's ever heard of, at least that I've talked to, an allergic reaction like that with tamoxifen.
Yeah, I mean, you can.
I just wondered if you had.
You could talk to your physician about stopping the tamoxifen for a little while, see how you're doing, because usually when you start tamoxifen, you're going to be on it for 5 years. And so you'd stop it for a little while, see if it goes away, and also investigate alternatives to tamoxifen, because depending on your age, there may be other drugs you can use aside from tamoxifen.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday with nurse practitioner Erin Lasher and Dr. Regina Resta of New York Oncology Hematology. And let's now go to Donna in Wappingers Falls. Donna.
Hi. Is there a relationship between COVID or cancer and lymphedema? Wait, can someone have lymphedema before they have cancer, or what?
I'll try to answer that. Did you ask whether, Donna, whether there's a relation between lymphedema and COVID?
Cancer.
Okay. Well, I think there is, because both have clotting, or maybe they don't. I don't know. That's what I was wondering.
Oh, I see. That's very interesting. Because, yes, I mean, COVID has been, we're learning more and more about it, which I wish we didn't have to learn it, but there's certainly a clotting
problem. I'm all too interested.
Right. Clotting problems with COVID, which are sort of poorly defined. Lymphedema has been around for so many years, and we really honestly still don't know what causes it. I have not seen any association between COVID and lymphedema, but lymphedema is more of a chronic issue, and so we've only had COVID for, you know, the last few months, and so I haven't seen anybody talk about that.
Right.
Yeah, well, I heard about it. There's a place at Mount Sinai that's really doing, you know, gathering a lot of data and a lot of information. And I was wondering if it would pay to contact them and ask.
Absolutely. Mount Sinai in New York City is sort of a hotbed for COVID research. So, absolutely.
All right, Donna, thanks a lot for the call. This email from Sheila. Sheila said, I heard you mention telltale signs for possible skin cancer. I'll be watching for moles. But aside from looking at the skin, what other signs can we watch for? Are there indications in results from blood work, perhaps? And that is from Sheila.
As much as we are moving more and more towards trying to come up with sort of a holy grail looking for blood tests for cancer, we're not quite there yet. But we're getting closer. However, for skin cancer, really, it's physical exam. There's no really good blood test screening for skin cancer.
All right, back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Harlan, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from East Greenbush.
You are on, sir. Go.
So my question is, how much experience does the group have with medullary thyroid cancer, and are you aware of the recent targeted therapies that have shown huge success?
Another Very good question. Medullary thyroid cancer is not your common run-of-the-mill thyroid cancer. And run-of-the-mill thyroid cancer is usually cared for by endocrinologists rather than oncologists. And we only get involved if it's a very advanced case, which is uncommon. Medullary thyroid cancer, on the other hand, is more of a cancer that originates in different cells in the thyroid, something called the C cells or parafollicular cells. And it's probably maybe 1% of all the thyroid cancers. So you're talking about something we don't see all that much. And if I have somebody with thyroid cancer, I usually will call my sister, who's an endocrinologist, frankly.
All right, Harlan, thank you very much. Over to Melanie in Germantown. Melanie.
Yeah, hi. I was calling because my husband was diagnosed a year ago with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he's been on a drug called Improviva, which is supposed to be the amazing drug. Of course, it's not covered totally under insurance, and he's very tired, walking very slow. Did this drug affect that?
So your question is, can Imbruvica or ibrutinib cause fatigue?
Yes.
And the answer to that is, I don't really know the details of your husband's diagnosis, but non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in and of itself can cause fatigue, so there's that one issue we need to look for. But Imbruvica or ibrutinib is one of these targeted drugs that my nurse practitioner Erin was talking about, in that there are side effects to these drugs. They're just different. And absolutely, a drug like that can cause fatigue. Not uncommon at all. But you have to weigh the risks of treatment with the benefits.
Okay.
Thanks, Melanie. And now to Anne in Connecticut. Anne, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because my mother, shortly before her death, broke her femur, and when they were repairing it, they discovered that it was metastatic bone cancer. It was so degraded at that point that they couldn't determine the original origin of the cancer. In going through her paperwork after her death, I had found that about 12 years earlier, she had had an abnormal mammogram. Then they followed up and then said everything was clear. That was, because of other health concerns, her last mammogram that she ever had. I know her lungs had been studied a number of times because she had been a former smoker and any issue went to her lungs. So I think her lungs would be clear as the primary source of cancer. Do I consider myself the child, the daughter of somebody with breast cancer, given that history, when I go for my mammogram and things like that?
First of all, I'm very sorry about your mom.
Oh, thank you. She led a good life.
Good. That's good. But it's not rare for certain cancers to present first off with bone metastases, unfortunately. And sometimes we're even not able to figure out where it started, even at autopsy. Primary bone tumors are not common. Much more common to have a cancer that's metastatic to the bone, like a lung cancer or a breast cancer. But I think you'd have to consider yourself, honestly, that she just had what we call a carcinoma of unknown primary, or a CUP.
Okay.
We just don't know where it came from.
And thank you very much for the call. We are joined today by Dr. Regina Resta and nurse practitioner Erin Lasher of New York Oncology Hematology. And a couple of minutes left here on the program, and let's go back to the phones. Ellie in Rotterdam. Ellie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed with lung cancer last year and had a tumor removed from my lungs. And then, unfortunately, they found some cells in my lymph nodes. So I did have 3 sessions of chemo, and then I decided I didn't want them anymore. And it was stage 3 now. So now I'm on this medication, Tagrisso, which hasn't been approved by FDA yet. So I had to get it prescribed by Sloan Kettering, even though my oncologist is monitoring it. And he said once it gets approved by FDA, then he could take over and prescribe it. So I'm getting the Tagrisso from Sloan Kettering. On a side, it's like cost me $800 for 30 pills every month, but, you know, it's worth it when it comes to your health. But, and that's after insurance. Mm. But what I'm wondering is, they can detect tumors, but apparently they can't detect cancer cells yet, which are supposed to slow the growth. So I don't even know if I have cancer cells or not, but you don't take any chances, so I keep taking the Tagrisso. And is it, Tagrisso looking pretty good that soon they'll be able to detect whether there's cancer cells here or not? Then I can stop this $800 a month Tagrisso okay. with side effects.
All right, we only have about a minute here, so go ahead, doctor.
Oh, that's just such a complicated question. I don't even know where to begin. I would ask my physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering who's prescribing the drug. But there are osimertinib really has only been proven to work clearly in cancers that have a specific mutation in the EGFR receptor. So I presume that your cancer had that mutation. And there was some very good recent study that came out at our ASCO meetings in June about using osimertinib in this sort of situation. So check with your doctor on that.
Okay. And Ellie, thank you. That'll have to be it for the program. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Resta and Nurse Lasher of New York Oncology Hematology. Really appreciate you both being here. Stay healthy, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for Medical Monday comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Cusack, continuing his work for over four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction. VillaVeritas.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Resta and Nurse Lasher for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the calls and the emails. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Charlene Knight took the calls. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, we welcome our copyright experts, at least two of them, to answer your questions about intellectual property. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.